By the summer of 1952, the United States had been mired for 2 years in the war in Korea. For can-do Americans, proud of their power, the deadlock was frustrating, even humiliating. In fact, the whole global struggle against communism seemed to be running against them. Dwight Eisenhower, five-star general and presidential candidate, laid it on the line in a speech to U.S. veterans, using the hallowed language of liberty and slavery.
We are threatened by a great tyranny, a tyranny that is brutal in its primitiveness. It is a tyranny that has brought thousands, millions of people into slave camps and is attempting to make all humankind its chattel.
Eisenhower listed the countries of Eastern Europe that had fallen under the Soviet yoke, from the Baltic to the Black Sea. 90 million people in countries like Poland and East Germany.
All these people are blood kin to us. The American conscience can never know peace until these people are restored again to be masters of their own fate.
In speeches like this, candidate Eisenhower implied that, as president, he would roll back the red tide. Although this was election rhetoric, which he later downplayed, Eisenhower's 8-year presidency, from January 1953, locked the US into Cold War confrontation on a truly global scale. In the process, Americans became more prosperous and yet less secure than at any time in their history. Eisenhower won the election for the Republicans by a landslide. The Democrats were irreparably tarnished by the mess President Harry Truman had left in Korea. And the new leader's cheery manner and military record provided the kind of reassurance Americans now craved. The new administration believed in balanced budgets, or at least reduced government spending. It also wanted to avoid getting bogged down in another unwinnable ground war. The answer was greater reliance on America's nuclear arsenal. John Foster Dulles, Eisenhower's Secretary of State, explained,
"There is no local defense which alone will contain the mighty land power of the communist world. Local defenses must be reinforced by a further deterrent of massive retaliatory power."
So the administration built up Strategic Air Command with its network of jet-propelled heavy bombers, airborne refueling tankers, and overseas bases. The scenario for a possible war was outlined in 1954 by General Curtis LeMay, architect of the saturation bombing of Japan during World War II. An admiring officer took notes.
"Many heavy lines were shown progressively converging on the heart of Russia, with pretty stars to indicate the many bombs dropped on desired ground zeros. The final impression was that virtually all of Russia would be nothing but a smoking, radiating ruin at the end of 2 hours."
Other parts of the communist world would also require attention, of course, but
"It seemed apparent from General LeMay's answer that he is firmly convinced that 30 days is long enough to conclude World War III.
The threat of massive retaliation by airborne nuclear weapons became the centerpiece of Eisenhower's new look defense policy. At the other end of the administration's spectrum of ways to avoid costly ground wars, it advocated covert operations to destabilize its enemies. This became a big new enterprise for the Central Intelligence Agency, headed by Alan Dulles, a wartime spymaster and the brother of the Secretary of State. A special report for the president in 1954 justified the CIA's no-holds-barred policy.
"Hitherto acceptable norms of human conduct do not apply. If the United States is to survive, long-standing American concepts of fair play must be reconsidered. We must learn to subvert, sabotage, and destroy our enemies by more clever, more sophisticated, and more effective methods than those used against us."
In the global struggle against Soviet imperialism, Alan Dulles was saying, traditional American values of liberty had to take second place. This was the start of a slippery slope in foreign policy, which would lead on in our own day to extraordinary rendition and Guantanamo Bay. In the 50s, however, Most Americans were more concerned about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness at home. Between 1952 and 1955, the number of households with TV sets doubled to 32 million, roughly three-quarters of all homes in America. Watching television became the main leisure activity.
How elegant! The most elegant cake of all, chiffon, now dramatically different.
With the three main TV networks, all funded by commercials, broadcasters concentrated on mass-market programs.
Taste it. Every tender bite is soft.
The effect was increasingly a mass nationwide culture. News and current affairs were marginal, encouraging a confidently American-centered view of the world.
Delicious.
Television began to shape politics as well. Whereas Truman in 1948 had campaigned from a train, 19th century style, 4 years later, Eisenhower's campaign concentrated on TV spot commercials to sell their man to the nation. One of his aides identified the target voter.
I think of a man who hesitates between two levers, as if he were pausing between competing tubes of toothpaste in a drugstore. The brand that has made the highest penetration on his brain will win his choice.
The idea of a presidential election as a contest between Colgate and Gleam appalled Democratic purists, but this was increasingly the name of the game. Supermarkets also came of age in the Eisenhower years, accounting for 60% of America's retail food trade by 1955. Hollywood-style openings were commonplace.
Even blasé New Yorkers gawked at the razzle-dazzle last week when Food Fair Stores, Inc. opened two spick-and-span new supermarkets. Skywriting planes soared overhead. Models paraded by in hats, adorned with lobsters and sirloin steaks. Shoppers snatched at bargains, chickens at 39 cents a pound, and boggled at such curiosities as ostrich eggs at $15 a piece.
As in the 20s, music was central to the consumer boom, spread by the new vinyl-coated records and even more by transistor radios. The rage now was for rock and roll, a blend of black blues and white country music. Early exponents were Bill Haley and Chuck Berry. But Haley was too old for mega stardom, and Berry was black. Sam Phillips of Sun Records in Memphis, Tennessee, lamented,
"If I could find a white boy who could sing like a nigger, I could make $1 million."
His prayer was answered by a young, music-mad truck driver called Elvis Aaron Presley.
Well, bless my soul, what's wrong with me? I'm itching like a man on a fuzzy tree. My friends say I'm acting wild as a bug. I'm in love. I'm all shook up.
Elvis drove thousands of teenage girls into screaming frenzy and their elders into angry contempt. The America-based correspondent of the London Times reported snootily,
"Mr. Presley, now the proud owner of three Cadillacs and hundreds of the violent sport shirts he affects, says, I wouldn't want no regular spot on no TV program. I love to act. I don't care nothing whatsoever about singing in no movie." Mr. Presley adds by way of illustration that English was what he liked best at school.
My heart beats so it scares me to death when she touches.
American consumer culture even became a battleground in the Cold War when Eisenhower's vice president, Richard Nixon, visited Moscow in July 1959. He and the Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev debated the merits of their rival systems in the mock-up of a modern American house at an international exhibition.
Now, I want to show you this kitchen. It is like those of our houses in California.
We have such things.
Well, this dishwasher is our newest model. In America, we like to make life easier for women.
Your capitalistic attitude towards women does not occur under communism.
Well, I think that this attitude towards women is universal. What we want to do is make life more easy for our housewives.
But Khrushchev gave as good as he got.
This is what America is capable of? And how long has she existed? 150 years of independence, and this is her level? We haven't quite reached 42 years, and in another 7 years, we'll be at the level of America. And after that, we'll go farther. As we pass you by, we'll wave hi to you. And then, if you want, we'll stop and say, please, come along behind us.
The Soviet leader was a pugnacious little blusterer. But in 1959, his confidence didn't seem misplaced. He was still pumped up by what had happened 2 years before. That eerie beep came from Sputnik, the first man-made satellite. Silver-coloured, beachball size, with two whisker-like antennae. It was launched into orbit around the Earth on October the 4th, 1957. The beeps were replayed all over the world, haunting the Eisenhower administration. For communist Russia, not high-tech America, had been first into space. Criticism of Eisenhower had already been mounting. There were reports of heart trouble and too much time on the golf course. With the launch of Sputnik, America's leader now looked dangerously out of touch. The governor of Michigan, a Democrat, penned this scathing verse.
Oh, little Sputnik, flying high with made-in-Moscow beep. You tell the world it's a commie sky and Uncle Sam's asleep. You say on fairway and on rough, the Kremlin knows it all. We hope our golfer knows enough to get us on the ball.
Sputnik was a massive shock to America's national pride, kick-starting a major program of scientific education in schools. The commie sky had even more sinister implications. Sputnik had been launched by an R-7 rocket, which had sufficient range and power to hit the United States with a nuclear warhead in less than an hour. A media panic gripped America, which the Democrats played on for partisan advantage. Senator Lyndon Johnson told special hearings,
"We meet today in the atmosphere of another Pearl Harbor. We are in a race for survival, and we intend to win that race."
In fact, the situation seemed worse than in 1941, because Pearl Harbor was an outlying possession of the United States, 2,000 miles from California. Throughout World War II, the continental U.S. had remained virtually untouched, nor was it threatened in the early Cold War, because the Soviets didn't have bombers of sufficient range. But at the end of the 1950s, in the dawning era of intercontinental missiles, Americans felt vulnerable as never before. Until now, better dead than red had been an easy slogan. Soon, it might be a real choice.